From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, how Marquette University's role in addressing trauma in Milwaukee can be traced to its president, Michael Lovell.
The work that he is doing in tandem with his wife at the university cuts to the core of trauma-informed research in the city. What they're building together really is uniting people in ways that haven't happened to this point at this level.
Later, we'll check in with Lake Effect's Bonnie North on a journalism fellowship in Europe.
Artist and writer Nathaniel Stern's latest book opens a window on ecological aesthetics.
It tells stories about artists and their artworks in order to get us to think with and think differently with the world around us.
And Wisconsin poet DeWitt Clinton talks about his new collection and how his work has been shaped by many influences in his life.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Next week, several Milwaukee institutions and organizations will focus attention on the interconnection of race, trauma, and recovery in the community. A public gathering to talk about the issues is scheduled for Wednesday, with a professional conference set to happen on Thursday and Friday.
Ahead of all that, Marquette University will also bring together experts in the field for a Tuesday panel discussion on generational stress and trauma. Writer Zach Brooks' article in this month's Milwaukee Magazine explains that Marquette's interest in the field can at least partly be traced to the man leading the university, President Michael Lovell. Zach Brooks joins us in the studio to explain. Nice to see you again.
Good to be back.
There are a lot of people doing work on trauma and trauma-informed care in Milwaukee. Why is Mike Lovell, the president of Marquette University, the lens through which to tell this story?
Well, Mike Lovell is the lens for two reasons. One, because the work that he is doing in tandem with his wife at the university cuts to the core of trauma-informed research in the city. What they're building together through their program SWIM really is uniting people in ways that haven't happened to this point at this level. And so that's why he's a centerpiece. The other reason, the more personal reason, is that in order to lead on this issue, he's decided to go public with his own traumatic upbringing, which he's been here for 10 years and hasn't talked about it yet. This is not something that comes easy to him, that he wants to openly volunteer, but he understands that if we're to start talking about trauma, he needs to tell his own story.
Right. So I gather he's opening up at least a bit about trauma in his childhood, but only to a point.
Yeah, I think for him, the focus would be more on the resilience. Like, he doesn't want to dwell on the bad stuff that happened in his childhood, and nor does he want to, I think, depict his childhood as one endless stream of traumatic events with no positive sprinkled in there. He wants to paint a picture of someone who experienced very traumatic things in his household growing up, but nevertheless bounced back, in part because of what was in him, but also because he had what therapists are saying are needed to overcome instances of trauma early in life, which is a close-knit social network, adults you can trust, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. And one of the things that we do know is that he scored a 5 out of 10 on the ACE test, the Adverse Childhood Experiences survey.
Correct. The ACE survey has also gained a lot of traction in recent years, a lot of prominence. And what it measures, this is not a test that you want to score high on. This is the lower the better. It measures the amount of adversity a child has scored in their childhood. And this would be things like domestic abuse in the home, things like mental illness in the home, things like, you know, sexual violence towards children, stuff like that. That's all in the classic test. The classic test is 10 questions. Certainly there are traumatic experiences that can happen to children that fall outside the classic test. And I mean, there are traumatic experiences that can happen to adults. Once you hit 18, that doesn't mean trauma stops happening to you. But the ACE test is really the, right now, primary tool to understand how trauma affects children and how it can be treated.
Right. And from what I gather, scoring highly, you know, that is poorly on the ACE test has an impact on everything from learning disabilities to physical ailments.
That's correct. I mean, you know, the research is there's a lot of research being conducted right now in this area. And, you know, there's a lot yet to come. But what we know so far is that, you know, if you score poorly, you are a lot less likely to trust adult authority figures. So you're going to act out in the classroom. You might end up in like the juvenile criminal justice system. There has been research that linked it to, you know, higher levels of like cardiac defects. I'm not, you know, I don't have a PhD, careful on how I'm going to put this, but that study does exist in JAMA Pediatrics that finds that, you know, people with high levels of trauma have, you know, it shows up in their cardiology.
If he is not speaking specifically about many issues that he faced, what has he said in terms of developing these coping skills, his resilience that, you know, clearly shows through and that he has been a pretty high achieving guy?
Well, it's not that he said nothing. It's not that he said, I got five aces, but I'm not going to talk about them. I mean, he'll be open that says there was drinking in the home that he grew up in. There was more than just drinking. There was alcoholism. His grandfather committed suicide or died by suicide when he was like 5 years old, 4 or 5 years old. And then his mother had a couple suicide attempts. This is all stuff he's been public about, both in my story and in stories published in the journal Sentinel. He credits his faith. Mike Lovell has worn his Catholicism on his sleeve basically the entire time he's been in Milwaukee, and probably for a lot longer, to be honest. He met his wife. One of their first dates was attending Mass together, I think a weekday Mass at that. He credits his faith, but more than his faith, he credits like the tangible adults in his life that saw what was going on in his home. Maybe didn't know everything, but saw that him and his sister were two children that definitely needed help, or they were going to fall through the cracks. Whether it was the friends or the parents of his friends, whether it was he was a four-sport athlete, you know, year-round athlete in school growing up, whether it was his coaches, certain teachers. He's also excelled academically, so I'm sure he's had connections with teachers, you know, just community members. Somebody, he doesn't know who, but somebody was concerned enough about what was going on in that house that they actually instigated a social worker come and visit him and his sister periodically.
As you say, this is really just half the story. Understanding where Mike Lovell and his wife are both coming from, moreover, offers insight into the role that Marquette is playing as a convener in regard to dealing with the influence of trauma around the Milwaukee area.
Yes, that's correct. Amy Lovell, Mike's wife, is just as much a part of this as Mike is, and Amy has been working in some really touchy, traumatic areas since like 2013 when she started or when she helped start RedGen, which is a nonprofit primarily located in the North Shore that deals with youth suicide. There was a spate of suicides in the area around that time, including a young girl who is a friend of the Lovell's daughter, and she got involved in that. So RedGen is SWIM is something different from RedGen, but Amy's been working on this for a couple years now. And now what SWIM does is they've been very clear that they don't want to take anybody else's thunder and they don't want to repeat any services that are being provided. What they do want to do is serve as a conduit, use the Marquette resources and name to bring coalition together of different groups that work on different facets of trauma, whether it's job training, whether it's, you know, healthcare, whether it's child services. And to that end, they've partnered with St. A, which has gotten national attention for trauma-informed care in the form of a 60 Minutes piece that was conducted by Oprah Winfrey. They've partnered with St. A to sponsor this trauma conference that will be happening next week.
Moreover, there are a number of other institutions that are doing work on this issue, not the least of which is President Lovell's previous employer, UW-Milwaukee, which seems to speak highly of the work that that's being done as well.
Yeah, the Helen Bader School of Public Health, that was something that UWM has a lot of pride in and puts a lot of resources into. And they currently are working on all sorts of research on how trauma affects the community and, more importantly, how trauma can be managed. There's one program, a pilot program, for instance, called Healthy Workers, Healthy Wisconsin, that actually screens applicants for how much trauma they might be carrying around with them, and then sends them to appropriate providers to help get that managed. And these are people that the applicants can be open with. For instance, if you were interviewing me for a job, I'm not going to be particularly open if I have a substance abuse problem. They can tell these people that, and it won't get back to wherever they're applying to, and hopefully they can get help for it.
Well, Zach Brook, it's an interesting article. Thank you so much for sharing what you learned.
Always great to be here. Thank you.
Freelance writer Zach Brook wrote about Marquette University President Mike Lovell and the broader effort to address trauma in the community for the September issue of Milwaukee Magazine. You can find links to more about the upcoming conference on trauma in the community at WUWM.com.
Keep listening. Lake Effect's Bonnie North is currently on assignment in Europe. We'll find out what she's working on when Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Lake Effect producer and co-host Bonnie North is away from the station for a few weeks, but she is at work. Bonnie is a part of a journalism fellowship that will take her to several countries in Europe.
She arrived overseas a few days ago, and she joins us via Skype today to explain what she's up to. Hi, Bonnie. Why don't you start by explaining where you are right now and what you're doing?
I'm in Cologne, Germany, Mitch. I'm here on a two-week fellowship with the RIAS Berlin Commission, and that is a commission that was set up when reunification happened in Germany to basically give German and American journalists a chance to meet each other, learn how we do our jobs in different countries with somewhat different standards, not really journalistic standards, but mostly production standards. And so this is day three that we are talking right now. We spent the first 2 days in Brussels going to the European Commission and to NATO, which was pretty spectacular. And we are in Cologne right now because we have visited in the morning WDR, which is one of the largest public broadcasting services in Germany. And we spent the afternoon at RTL Studios, which it's part of the Bertelsmann Group. So it's there's like CNN is a sister network. This is actually a commercial network. And so we got tours of studios, mostly television here. It was radio in the morning.
Who are the kinds of people that you've had a chance to speak with?
I've met everyone from what they call presenters here, the way the Brits would call it, hosts. I've met people who run cameras. I've met people who do the production. There's very little self-production I found here, particularly on the radio side. There was a team of producers. They're writing scripts and they're getting callers. So some of it's live calling, some of it's music, some of it's pre-produced packages. And the folks who are with me are a spectrum of people who are from around the United States. Most of them are TV folks. There's a couple of us radio diehards in the mix, but they're, you know, working everywhere from CNN to, you know, Milwaukee Public Radio. And so it's a really nice mix just amongst us as well.
Now, over the course of the 2 weeks, you're not just spending time with journalists, but you're also getting briefings and learning about international affairs, right?
Yes, we are. We had the first 2 days in Belgium were mostly spent inside buildings talking to people or having people talk to us really about the EU Commission on the first day, what they do, what the mission is, the kinds of things they can and can't do, particularly in reference to the refugee crisis, as well as trade issues. I think probably the most important thing I learned there was that the European Commission can't enact or force anybody to do anything. They have a little bit of push and pull, but it's the 28 member states that decide, of course, their internal affairs, and then hopefully that match with what the EU is hoping to happen over Europe in general. So, for example, with the refugee crisis, I can't really go into a lot of detail because they briefed us off the record. But there's a lot of concern about equality and making sure that all the member states do what they're supposed to do, that everyone is supposed to take in a certain number, like 2% of whatever. You know, there's a lot of numbers that are bandied about, but not everyone, of course, is doing that. There's a lot of resistance from particularly Hungary and Poland for taking any refugees at all, and Germany gets a lot of them, and so do France takes quite a few as well. So that crisis is kind of, it's not, they won't call it a crisis anymore, but it's an ongoing issue that is taking up a lot of time. Trade, of course, is another one. And we also learned a lot about sort of the historic trading parameters and what the sanctions that President Trump has either proposed or wants to propose, what that's going to do, because we are, they kept informing us or kept reminding us that Europe is our biggest trading partner. And so there's a lot at play there as well.
So you spend time in Brussels. We're talking with you in Cologne. Where do you go after that?
Tomorrow morning, we are on the train. By the time actually you hear this, I will be on a train to Mainz, Germany. We're taking the train down the Rhine. It's our most scenic train journey, I'm told, which will be a lot of fun. And we'll be visiting some other broadcasters there. But I wanted to go back to Cologne for just a minute. We spent the morning with WDR. It's Cosmo is the name of the program. It's kind of geared towards the younger listener. And here are some numbers that will make all public radio people envious. They have 55% of the listening audience in Germany, which we all, our jaws dropped. That is kind of astounding to me. And their budget overall for public broadcasting in Germany is 8 billion, that's with a B, euros. WDR, the biggest public broadcaster that has both TV and radio, gets 2 billion with a B again per year in budget.
So nice microphones.
Very, very nice microphones. Anyone who's following my Facebook feed will see that I've been taking pictures of all the Neumann microphones that are in there. But it's not just the equipment. I mean, the equipment is spectacular and, you know, really well appointed. But they have lots and lots of people doing really, really intense work. Bureaucracy in Germany gets a bad rap, but they certainly seem to want to have their public broadcasting.
We'll be checking in with you in the next few days, but we'll also be hearing some of the tape that you've had a chance to collect there. And in the coming days, we're going to hear the first of these interviews. Why don't you tell us a little bit about who it's with and the kinds of things that you talked about?
This actually was recorded on Tuesday at NATO headquarters in Brussels, and we had an entire day of meetings and briefings there with various folks. And this was with Piers Cazalet, and he is the head of press and media NATO, and therefore authorized to speak to the media. That was one of the problems we had at the EU, that everyone that briefed us was not authorized to actually give an on-the-record interview, even if it was just a recap of what we had just been briefed. And so finding somebody in Brussels to actually, because I'm not part of the typical press corps, you have, there's a lot of layers of bureaucracy that you have to go through to be in those press briefings, and we didn't have that, of course. But Piers mostly talked about why NATO is still important, what the alliance is doing, how it's adjusting to 2018 and beyond, why it's still important for the United States and Canada to be very much a part of this alliance, you know, what they're trying to, what they can and can't do in terms of refugees and terrorism. That was the other thing we were talking about. They call it the southern problem because for them, of course, you know, you're looking at North Africa and you're looking at the Middle East as problem places. We heard a lot about the history of NATO, why it's important, and what what he thinks it's going to look like in the future.
Well, we will look forward to hearing that interview and look forward to checking in with you again a couple more times in the coming days. Bonnie, thanks.
You are very welcome, Mitch.
That's Lake Effect's Bonnie North on the line from Cologne, Germany, where she's part of a journalism fellowship through the Ries Berlin Commission. You can see photos from the road and a link to the blog she's writing on location at WUWM.com.
We'll take another quick break, and then artist and professor Nathaniel Stern joins us to talk about his new book and explain what he means by ecological aesthetics. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich. How do you think about the objects around you? What do they do for you? What do they want? Are they art? These are some of the ways that local artist and author Nathaniel Stern wants us to think about our surroundings, our planet, and the art within it.
His new book argues that all things, all matter in fact, argues for itself. His book is called Ecological Aesthetics, and he joined Lake Effect's Madeline Andre to dissect what exactly that means.
The aesthetics in ecological aesthetics is a kind of style or orientation towards different modes of thinking, whether that's about personal, political, or ethical decisions that we make. We can think about these things aesthetically. It's what can be said, shown, experienced, or practiced, how it is said, shown, experienced, or practiced, why, and most importantly, the stakes therein. And so here, aesthetics lead to action. The ecological and ecological aesthetics follows a trajectory by a number of philosophers that look at the world as a kind of complex system of forces. If you don't mind, I'm going to read a little excerpt to kind of give a sense of what I mean by that. The fact of matter is that it all argues. Matter perceives, matter moves, it feels and it thinks. Matter perceives in that it takes account of its surroundings and shifts trajectories of becoming. A tree grows around that tiresome river or toward the light of its fancy. An electron jumps and swerves from atom to molecule and eventually finds its desired equilibrium. A cliff erodes against water and wind, perhaps eventually crashing into the sea. The sea then moves in and around a torrent of interfering waves and currents in its new and always ongoing composition. And matter changes as it moves as well. A molecule's proximity to another changes density. Jumping electrons change the molecule, and so on. Matter feels outward and perceives and moves, responds and reacts, then feels and perceives and moves and changes once again. Matter thinks and argues, perhaps not in the way a human consciousness thinks or argues, but any dash thing, and certainly this book, can be said to be part of, as intellectual historian Nicole Ridgway calls it, an event of thought. Is thought exclusively human? Only in as much as my own thoughts are exclusively my own, and they are most certainly not. Other thoughts and ideas and arguments preceded what I think, and these changed me, my thoughts, my ideas. These other thoughts were themselves not completely original, were birthed, transformed, and amplified by other things, both human and non-human. Artists and artworks, writers and writings, books and the internet and the various pages therein, the earth, the sky, that blue, this light, the fact that I lost my keys or they lost me the day I originally typed this very sentence. Side note, aforesaid keys do not agree that they belong to me or even that we belong together. They are often co-conspiring with pockets, each other, gravity, and a plethora of other collaborators of this, I am sure, so as to make me look bad to my colleagues and peers. Each of these bodies is a force on thought, a force of thought, a thought in the act. And so ecological aesthetics kind of takes as its premise that everything has an aesthetic approach that it perceives and responds and reacts, takes some agency in the making of the world. And then artists and artworks amplify certain aspects of the world we live in to bring our attention to them, to maybe ask us to behave differently or better with the world around us. And then this book takes an aesthetic approach too. It tells stories about artists and their artworks in order to get us to think with and think differently with the world around us. And so to me, an aesthetic choice is a political choice in that way.
Your last interview that you had with Bonnie here at Lake Effect, you were talking about your new rig for scanning. Can you give us an update on that at all?
Was it if I'm remembering correctly, at that point, I take desktop scanners. Just let's catch up here.
Yeah,
I take desktop scanners, traditional things that you would scan in your license with in order to send off, although nowadays people use their phones more than scanners. When I started with this series, scanners were like new and cutting edge, and now they're kind of quaint. But I take these desktop scanners, I make custom battery packs, strap them to my body with a computing device and I go out and traverse the landscape. So I might scan in straight long lines across tables, tie the scanner around my neck and swing over flowers, do pogo-like gestures over bricks, or just follow the wind over water lilies in a pond. And so what you see in each image are these kind of strips that are actually adjacent times and spaces because of the relation of how I move the scanner across the landscape while the scanner beam is moving across the surface of the glass. And you can see where this fits in with humans' nature and politics, moving, thinking, and feeling with. At that point, I was trying to build an underwater rig and take the scanner scuba diving off a reef in Key West. I did. Everything leaked. Everything broke. nothing did what I wanted or expected, as must have happened, right? Mm-hmm. Of course. That said, I managed to salvage a series of 14 images that are just beautiful and really show and feel the kind of movements of breathing and gravity and waves and plant life. They're all there's a video about it on my website now, and all the images are there. And I was really happy with the outcomes, although I was invited a number of times to do it again, and I just can't because it's all broken. Mm-hmm. and so it was a one-time thing. Now I'm still experimenting with this series because I learned so much the more I do it. And in fact, because of the underwater rig, even though I no longer have one that can withstand going underwater, I've managed to make it more portable and easy to use because of all that research. And so although autumn and the changing colors of the leaves only really lasts a week or two in Milwaukee, I went out a couple of years ago and managed to capture some beautiful foliage on the lakefront here in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. And I've turned that into a new series of modular prints. They're actually in metal. So it uses a process that turns the ink into a gas and goes into a porous aluminum. So the metal is extremely shiny. It's in the metal rather than on the metal. And so it feels almost like a computer screen, but then it's got these beautiful fall colors that are really earthy to combine that with. And that'll be an exhibition at the James Watrous Gallery in Madison that opens in November, and it'll be up through January. And I'll actually be giving a scanner hacking workshop in January. I'll put some information on my website or send it to you.
Yeah.
So I can teach people how to make battery packs, strap them to their scanners, and go out and make their own compressionist images.
Going back to that TED talk that you gave, has your idea of ecological aesthetics changed at all since then? Or has anything come out of your work to produce this book?
Yeah, thanks for asking that. So it's interesting. As an artist, so much influences me. Perhaps that's why I work in the ways I do. And so over the years, you know, I begin working on something, and this is the privilege of being an artist, and I think it's a great idea, and then it doesn't do what I want at all, but it does something else. And whether it tells me that it's doing something else or someone else tells me it's doing something else, as long as it's interesting and calls attention to how we relate to the world, I can try to amplify that further. And so it was through reading a number of philosophers that even brought me to call that TEDx talk Ecological Aesthetics. And that TED talk was about my own work, and I kind of talked about four different pieces and how they interrelated, and the notion of ecological aesthetics emerged from writing that TED talk. And it was only because of the popularity of that TED talk that I was convinced to write a book about it. And when I, as a writer, although I don't think of these two practices as distinct, my art making and my writing about art, I most often want to write about other artists and artworks. I never deny the fact that I'm an artist in my writing, and I'll maybe mention a work or two, but I'm really interested in the privilege that comes with getting to go out and talk to other artists and the amazing work they do. And, you know, I'm just so fascinated with different practices and approaches to the world, and I learned so much. I think once I set out on this journey, yes, one of the first chapters that I write about is an intervention at an art fair that's completely about the commercial art world and completely about politics and capitalism. And that is not what the everyday person thinks of when they think about general ecology, right? We usually relate it to bioorganisms or the environment. But it was precisely because of Guattari's tying everything to capitalism and the problems therein that I thought, let me explore this space a bit. And I found a group of New York artists that did a series of interventions at art fairs and tried to show the problematics where here are these artists trying to make things as a gift, trying to teach and learn within the world, and someone else is trying to profit off of it. And what do you do in that space? And so it went out from there. Some of the artists I write about make very what's considered everyday art, you know, prints with digital forms. And I talk about how electrons have agency there. But others, and that's Malcolm Levy's work, but others like Dung Anwar Jahangir, who's a Durban-based South African artist, his practice is walking. And I talk about how he orientates himself and asks others to think with the world around them just by going on these walks through dangerous neighborhoods. So yeah, it completely changed me and how I think. As an academic, I firmly believe in the peer review process. So when I sent the book out, it was sent out to one amazing earth art scholar named Amanda Butzkes, who I had never heard of before. And the kind of feedback that she gave me on the book really made me think about, well, what are the aesthetic choices that I made in this book? So I thought I was talking about this other work as ecological aesthetics. And she made me reconsider that this book itself has its own style and asks us to think differently, and that the thesis really is around storytelling and narratives and giving new life and meaning. And then finally, this inspired me. After talking to all of these artists and finishing the book, I had a new idea for a whole new body of work called The World After Us, which imagines what our cell phones and media devices might look like in a million years. And so I'm doing things like working with geoscientists at Cornell University and trying to turn phones into fertilizer or food as a different mode of recycling. I'm grinding phones up into powder, extending them with oil, turning them into ink, and then making prints. I'm melting down IMAX and the aluminum therein and turning them into hammers and saws. I'm turning them into planters. So if you can imagine an iMac turned sideways, gutted, and then wheatgrass glowing out. Of course, I call that applegrass.
That's really interesting that you bring up what might happen in a million years, because one of the things that I noticed reading about the artists in the book is the focus on time, or the concept of time, as an important part. I'm thinking specifically of the street trees, of Yevgenia
Kaganovich's
Grow focuses a lot on time, or the concept of it. Does that have an important role in ecological aesthetics? Is time an integral part of that?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for asking that and for noticing it. If nature and earth and environment are part of where we want to think with, then we have to start thinking in earth time. Our existence is so minute compared to the globe's. And in fact, when we look at our media devices and we think about what's in them, we have to think about the Earth's own movements and crusts and cores moving and changing in order to gift us with the copper, the palladium, the tin, right? It took time for the Earth to move and think and feel and create and give us the potentials to make those things. And conversely, in a million years, this phone will be and do something. And so to sympathize with, and remember, sympathize means together, feel. To sympathize with the world around us, we have to attempt to imagine. We can't possibly really understand rationally what that time feels like, but we can attempt to feel it. And I think this is what art and aesthetics can do. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Yevgenia Kaganovich, amazing, brilliant local artist. She's a colleague at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and Peck School of the Arts. And the work you're talking about, she just was really annoyed with those plastic bags that you get at Pick and Save, the ones that say thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you on them. They are horrible for the environment and impossible to recycle and, in her words, really ugly. And so she decided, you know, I'm going to do something with them. And so she painstakingly twists them and wraps them and stretches them into yarn and then knits them into these beautiful plants and has local collaborators, workshops, turning these into something beautiful, again, to reimagine over time what these things might be and do. And she can't keep up, but she's made communities of practice who think differently about waste. And I think that's an important part. If I can throw out there, I've got a book launch coming up. Rather than doing a kind of very traditional book launch, I'm going to be doing a brief reading from the book, and then I've actually invited three of the local artists to be with me there. So Yevgenia will be there, Wyatt Tinder, who currently works for Milwaukee, but was a graduating senior, and I decided to write about a student work in the book. And then Lisa Moline, who's one of the progenitors of the Overpass Light Brigade. So three local artists will be on a panel with me talking about this.
That's going to be so cool.
I'm excited about
it. Yeah.
They're great. You know, as a teacher and a writer and an artist, to me, discussions are so important. And keeping up, thinking with, thinking through, attuning to each other, helping one another on our way. I welcome people to get in touch. I welcome people to tell their own stories about art and artists, and I'll help them along their way too.
Nathaniel Stern is a Milwaukee-based visual artist and associate professor of art and design at UW-Milwaukee. He hosts a release for his book, Ecological Aesthetics, tonight at Boswell Book Company. There is more information about the work and its author at WUWM.com.
One more break, and then we'll speak with another writer who launches his new book on Friday at Boswell, too. Wisconsin poet DeWitt Clinton shares his remarkable journey when Like Effect continues in a moment on WUWM.
It's Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, ended last night at sundown. It's generally considered the holiest day of the year in Judaism. Years ago, it's a day that might have gone by unnoticed by DeWitt Clinton. Clinton was raised as a Methodist in Kansas.
But he came to Judaism and other spiritual traditions later in life after he was already established as a poet. Clinton's latest book of poetry is his first in some years. It's called At the End of the War. And DeWitt Clinton, who is also a professor emeritus at UW-Whitewater, joins us in the studio to talk about his work. He starts by reading an appropriate poem for this week. It is a poem based on the biblical book of Jonah entitled A Reading for Yom Kippur.
I took that rickiness pot, soil and all, carried it with me, attracting black flies, aphids. Even snails found comfort in what was barely left. In my arms, I knew this was all I could ever become. I didn't want anything, ever, again. The days returning home were the most pleasant, walks with fine persons who had not yet come into God's mind. My only taste, red lentils and stone-ground bread. What else is there? On journeys like this, I've discovered most men will become genuine. That has given me the greatest comfort. Now when I cross a wadi, I wonder if a flash flood won't carry me far away. Holding tight onto my pot, only then do I think back to that place. Those Ninevites are the only ones I truly think about. All the time, in fact. I despise them. I still wonder why God thought so much of them. That is why I wrap my arms around this poor tree. It's only then when I draw some comfort. I know I shouldn't. I should love man, but I really don't. The only time I found the world wondrous was deep inside that marvelous fish. Someday I will tell you what I saw. It bears repeating even now as you read my end of it in your old synagogues, making such a big bellyache out of my sad life. I have to tell you, the morning I woke to find that pitiful plant, I wept so much. But I feel better now, so don't make too much of what you hear this afternoon. Sometime I will tell you who I saw there and what the world would become. In the meantime, go read your story, and I will wait. We will meet soon enough.
Wow. Reading for Yom Kippur, that's DeWitt Clinton. Reading for us on Lake Effect. First of all, thank you so much and welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
First of all, you're a marvelous reader. You had me and I hope everyone in the palm of your hand.
I think what helped was taking a class back in college days called oral interpretation. And we had to practice and practice and practice our lines and a lot of it was dramatic readings of poetry and prose. I think there were some contests in high school and college for that.
So I've tried to piece together your personal history through reading your poetry and other writing, but I was hoping if I pieced it together correctly to have you walk us through how a Methodist minister's son from Kansas ended up a Jewish poet in Milwaukee.
Yes, it is quite a journey. I think I've been very drawn to the study of religion. I can't say that I have all of the profound traditional beliefs of the different religions, but yes, I started out with intentions of being a Methodist minister in Kansas, just like my father and my grandfather in Florida, but I ended up in Vietnam. And when I came home, I had no interest in the seminary. I thought maybe I could be a layperson. And then that didn't work out. I just sort of drifted away. And then my wife had been studying with a survivor from Nazi Germany, Hermann Weyl. And after several weeks of study, she invited me to come to the synagogue. I didn't even know what a synagogue looked like. I had no understanding whatsoever of Judaism. All I knew was something called the Old Testament. I had never heard of Torah. I was completely mesmerized by that evening, and I still am. It's what drew me to Judaism after such a long hiatus. And because of my college experience of teaching at UW-Whitewater, I began teaching or providing introductory sections to other religions. And Taoism came in, and Hinduism, which really baffled everyone, and Buddhism, and Stoicism, and all those religious and spiritual practices have sort of washed over me. I am a convert to Judaism, but probably to lots of other religious practices as well. As far as practicing the religion and ascribing to all of the rituals, I'm probably not there yet. But I am I'm drawn to Stoicism, to Buddhism, to Judaism. I've lost a little interest in Methodism.
Well, and the other thing that also strikes me about so many different faith traditions and faiths, I guess, is that so many of their writings, when you read them, they feel very much like poetry.
Absolutely. Most of the religions that I've come across, the Rig Vedas for Hinduism, the Dhammapada for Buddhism, so much of the Hebrew Bible or Torah has pages and pages of poetry. I don't recall too much poetry in the Methodist church services except for the hymns and such. But it's beautiful poetry in all these traditions. Stoicism has no poetry, and that's the last sort of philosophy or philosophical practice that I introduced to students at UW-Whitewater. It's more of a philosophical, therapeutic practice of life. But certainly many of the sutras in Buddhism are beautiful in prose as well as in poetry.
If this is how you came to Judaism and Taoism and Buddhism and these other traditions, how did you come to poetry?
It all goes back to my Methodist college in Kansas, Southwestern College. I was taking a class from the one poet in residence there, and I had written a very clumsy Christmas piece in sentences because I didn't know anything could be shorter than a sentence or a line. And so he said, why don't you turn that into poetry? And my instructor, Bill Ford, William Ford, was the first person who really introduced me to not so much reading poetry as I've been doing that before, but writing it. And tried connecting with him over the years and over the decades with him as well. And I went to Wichita State University and met various poets, Bruce Cutler, and my wife's first husband. I'm number two. And went on to Bowling Green, Ohio for the MFA program there. And Howard McCord. There's so many poets have influenced me. It's Howard who introduced me to the fusion of history and poetry probably more than anyone else. He introduced me to Maya and Inca and Aztec storylines, and I began to sort of figure out a way to reinterpret these. And I somehow think that the poems that are grounded in some kind of historical event are always more interesting if history is retold, because history is always revised. We're not reading the history from a classical Greek perspective. It's always something new, and that's what I've sort of done with poetry. So whether it's a Maya text called the Shalom Balam of Shumayel or the royal commentaries of the Incas, the first sort of Spanish Inca text that tells about the ancient lives of the Incans. So all those things interest me a lot, and it's developed something called improvisation or adaptation. It's a little bit like taking a bar of music and improvising it and playing it and doing riffs and things like that.
It's like jazz.
Like jazz, a lot of it. And some of those earlier books of poetry are jazz poems. And I don't know too much about jazz, which is fun.
As you were telling us about your history and how you came to poetry and these various people you've worked with and who've influenced you over time, where did Vietnam fall in that chronology?
Well, I was hoping to be in a Methodist seminary, so it wasn't planned at all. But I think what happened was when I was in Vietnam, I was on an artillery fire base, and in sort of a bizarre, desperate help for returning to my college days, I signed up for an extension class at the University of Kansas, Lawrence. And the syllabus was to read poetry. And I said, "Do you mind if I write some?" And he said, "Oh, well, go ahead." And I wrote a long poem called Spirit of the Bayonet Fighter in Vietnam and worked on it afterwards. And
Harper, you're writing poetry while you were on this? Wow.
And Harper and Row included it in one of their Vietnam anthologies. And it was like, well, that's a good start, Harper and Row. I'm sure it will continue. And it never has. It's been a different route than I expected.
There's a section of this new book that's actually a travelogue and not really poetry at all. Can you share the story of the trip to Lithuania and Poland and I guess the broader, more broadly, Eastern Europe that inspired this?
Yes, my wife and I joined an Alverno College. By the way, my wife is right here, Jacqueline, Dr. Jacqueline Clinton. We brought her in. Thought she would enjoy the morning.
It's a rare treat to have a studio audience.
We joined an Alverno College Holocaust study class. And after about 6 or 8 weeks of classes, we went on a tour of Lithuania and Poland. And we also got to Prague as well. And to get to that stage, we did a lot of reading. After meeting Herman Weil at our new synagogue, I began to take an interest in what he knew about the Holocaust. And I had just been reading more and more and more of it. So that by the time we did get to Poland and walked through what was once the Warsaw Ghetto, we saw the wall and walked through the Jewish cemetery and then moved on to Lublin and then moved on to Krakow. And outside of Krakow is Auschwitz-Birkenau. And we were just overwhelmed. And I think a lot of that came into the writing of poetry. At the time, I was reading and teaching the Tao Te Ching, a Chinese classic, and I began fusing some of the wisdom of Chinese literature of centuries ago with the images of walking through Birkenau. We were quite overwhelmed, and a lot of it has come into my poetry.
This is your first published work, first published book in quite some time. And I guess I'm wondering if there's a certain memory, a muscle memory of the whole process that comes back to you.
I hadn't planned on waiting so long. My intention was to publish a third book and a fourth, fifth, as I had the first and second one. They were about 2 or 3 years apart. But I kept sending work out, and the publishing world in poetry is fierce. And just because you sent something to a university or a small press doesn't mean that they responded in the way you hope they will, a lesson from Stoicism. So it just took a little bit longer than I had ever imagined. But these poems are written, for the most part, while I was teaching at Whitewater. There are some classroom poems. There are poems that make reference to driving to work, where I met the messengers of Job from the book of Job, although they were cranes who had arrived driving along with me in the car.
Well, DeWitt Clinton, I hope we can hear that poem now. But first, I want to say thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
It's been wonderful to be here. I get a chance to practice, which I need a lot of. This poem is entitled Job's Comforters Fly Over Wisconsin. And of course, that never happened. But one reads Job in the Jewish tradition when one is a mourner. And you sit on a very hard bench in your in one living room and try to be comforted by this very, very sad story. And as I was driving on my way on the back roads from Milwaukee to Whitewater, I would often find what are called trunk roads, which are not even state highways, just backcountry roads. And I'd be driving through forests and open prairies, and sometimes cranes would fly above, and I would just have to stop the car and get out and look. They're so beautiful. Once, driving across dry, husky cornfields, three cranes, which I saw take flight only seconds before, are now eyeball to eyeball as they cross where I once was, driving this autumn day on the way to lectures and papers, a life I lead when not in the forest. The three, quiet as fanned air, glide by just above my new green focus, where inside I begin babbling, speaking in tongues as I'm so moved, honored so close to Bill, I, and lice. The filthiest one manages to land in the passenger seat. The others argue, who's sitting on which side in the back? You got a problem, kid, the front seat passenger warns. When the comforters of Job arrive, I hardly expect old bug-eyed cranes, but they're better than more of those cellos and violins which usually take me across the fields into the town where I work. Buddy, the older one in the back fidgeting with the seatbelt. Buddy, he says, you wanted a prayer circle, right? This is us, man. I'm still trying to figure out how they got in, but I'm glad they're here. Wouldn't want it any other way. The other one in the back just stares, glad, I suppose, someone looked up and even smiled. It's only then that I know why we've begun to go back to everything old. We do it all. Love, sex, taxes, the budget, Afghanistan, the Pentagon, H1N1, even death. But the four-seater is beginning to stink some. Yet I won't ask them to leave. Every day we sort out more and more of what was left out so very long ago. I've even managed to stop picking at the lice when they take flight inside our little spot of misery.
Shorewood poet DeWitt Clinton reading his poem, Job's Comforters Fly Over Wisconsin. It's taken from his new collection, At the End of the War. He'll read from it tomorrow night at Boswell Book Company, and you can find more information at WUWM.com. And that's Thursday's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
It's 11 o'clock, and I hope you'll stay tuned because fresh air is next.